Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Friday, the 26th of July, these are our main stories. A boat carrying as many as 300 migrants sinks off the coast of Libya. The US government announces the resumption of federal executions. And as Europe swelters, what can be done to make life bearable in an age of rising temperatures? Also in this podcast, the threat to Kenya's donkey population.
There's been a huge rise in donkey abattoirs. And right now, there's the slaughter of at least 1,000 donkeys a day, which appears unsustainable.
And a spectacular fall from grace for one of China's most revered women. We begin with news of a shipwreck off the coast of Libya that could be one of the deadliest this year. Initial reports said as many as 150 people had died, though the final figure remains unclear. A further 150 were rescued by fishermen before being returned to Libya by coast guards. Sam Turner is the head of mission for Libya Search and Rescue with the medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF. He's been explaining how MSF staff have been helping the survivors.
Our teams were there at the disembarkation points where people were, who survived this incident were brought onto shore. They provided medical assistance, including referring seven people to hospital who had nearly drowned in the course of their time at sea. We also spoke to one of the fishermen who was involved in the rescue, and he said that he had seen at least 70 bodies in the water as they approached the stricken vessel.
In terms of the numbers of deaths that there have been this year, I said that this would be the worst loss of life if 150 is confirmed, but how many people have died in the course of the year? Is it still as high as previous years?
Absolutely. So it was 426 people was the figure to date, with this additional 100 or 150, depending on the final count. Now, whilst that number of over 500 by late July is actually lower than it has been in previous years, what we can see is that there has been a significant increase in the chance of death of people attempting to make this desperate crossing. That in previous years, there was maybe a 1 or 2% chance that someone might die in the course of attempting to cross the Mediterranean Sea. But so far, with these figures to date, it's over 5% chance. So that means that 1 in 20 of the people who attempt to make this crossing across the central Mediterranean are likely to die doing so.
And that, you're saying, is partly down to the fact that there are fewer search and rescue missions operating in the Med at the moment.
What we've seen over the last year particularly is actions continuing to be taken by European governments to restrict search and rescue activities in the central Mediterranean. That involves punitive actions to prevent NGO search and rescue vessels from operating, but also the withdrawal of the European Union's naval mission, Operation Sophia, which used to be operating in this area with a mandate for saving lives. They withdrew actually their ships earlier this year and no longer have any vessels in the area to be able to conduct this essential saving of lives in the central Med.
And presumably, just very briefly, Sam, you're also concerned about people being returned to Libya.
Absolutely. As we've seen in Libya, MSF has been working in detention centres where refugees and migrants are arbitrarily and indefinitely detained in inhumane conditions. Just 3 weeks ago, we saw an airstrike on Tadjoura Detention Centre that resulted in the death of 60 people and a further 70 wounded. 2 days ago, 30 people who were intercepted in the central Mediterranean by the Libyan Coast Guard were returned to that very same detention centre. There are now approximately 230 people in Tadjoura Detention Centre, the same place where so many people lost their lives so recently.
Sam Turner of MSF talking to Tim Franks. For the first time in more than a decade, the US government has announced that it will resume capital punishment. The executions have been scheduled for December this year and January 2020. I asked our reporter in Washington, Anthony Zerker, why the federal government had made this decision.
Donald Trump in the past has spoken about how the criminal justice system is a little too easy on convicted felons, that they're allowed too many appeals processes, that they're treated too nicely. And this could be effectively where the rubber meets the road on changing federal policy. He's been in favor of the death penalty in the past. And so here you have the federal government beginning to attempt to administer it again.
Most American states have their own rules as regards to the death penalty. Is this going to affect them in any way?
Not at all. The federal government has its own court system, and they have a very circumscribed set of places where they can impose the death penalty. It has to be a federal crime. There are several people on death row on the federal government who committed federal crimes. Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, who was the Boston Marathon bomber, and Dylan Roof, who was the man who shot at 9 parishioners, a white supremacist in South Carolina. These are people who violated federal law. States have their own criminal justice systems. They have their own death penalty, or they don't, and they process people their own way. So this is not going to affect those states where, I will say, the lion's share of death sentences are carried out.
As you indicated, President Trump is a strong supporter of capital punishment. Is that a feeling which is shared across the bulk of Americans?
Well, a majority of Americans, if you look at polls, still say they're in favor of the death penalty in certain circumstances. But that approval has been slowly going down. And part of the reason is that there are circumstances where it's been very clear that the death penalty has been imposed either in a discriminatory sort of way, i.e. more blacks are getting the death penalty than whites, or actually innocent people are being sentenced to death. DNA evidence has revealed some instances of that as well. So there have been a number of states, and increasingly growing number of states, that while they still have the death penalty on the books, haven't used it very recently. In a way, what the federal government is doing here cuts against the trend in this country, which is a trend moving away from imposition of the death penalty and circumscribing the uses of it, such as, you know, for people who are convicted for crimes as a minor, for people who have mental disabilities, for people who are particularly old or infirm. It seems like the amount of death penalty usage is getting narrowed. But here you see the federal government saying there are 5 people who they're going to execute at the end of this year.
Anthony Zerker. Ukraine has detained a Russian tanker in the port of Izmail, saying the ship was involved in Moscow's seizure of 3 Ukrainian vessels last November. A spokesperson for Russia's embassy in Kiev said the tanker's crew had been released and is returning to Russia. Steve Rosenberg reports.
Ukrainian officials say the seized tanker was used by Russia last November to block the Kerch Strait between the Black and Azov Seas off the coast of Crimea. That was the month Russian border guards had fired on and captured 3 Ukrainian naval vessels as they attempted to pass through the strait. In that incident, 24 Ukrainian sailors were arrested. They remain in custody. 8 months on, Ukraine's security service says that it seized the Russian tanker after the vessel docked in a port in Odessa region. Russia's foreign ministry has responded with a warning. There would be consequences, it said, if any Russian has been taken hostage.
Now here's an extraordinary story. A wealthy woman considered among the most virtuous and generous in all of China has experienced what can only be described as a major fall from grace. As the adopted mother of more than 100 children, Li Yensha was applauded for saving them from lives of destitution. Now, though, she's been convicted of crimes against those children and sentenced to 20 years in prison. More from our China media analyst, Kerry Allen.
She really became known in China as a very warm figure. I mean, she took in total 118 children, and she became known as the love mother. And the village that she was taking these children into is the love village. There was so much praise for her. But then details started coming out suggesting that she wasn't as good a mother as it seemed.
So a massive fall from grace. What has she been convicted of doing?
She's been convicted of a number of offences, including fraud, manipulation of children. The courts have said that she was using children. One of the examples that was given is that she was sending them out to construction sites and making them throw themselves in front of trucks so that she could stop construction in certain areas. She had that much power and influence. China was surprised by these allegations, and when she was arrested in May last year, the tide completely turned on her. She'd literally been known as this huge philanthropist. And now it was just shocking that all these details were coming out. There were tip-offs from the public over a number of years that led to her arrest and yesterday to her huge sentencing of 20 years.
What's happened to all these children she was looking after now?
Well, when she was arrested last year, the authorities said that there were about 70 children who were still within her care, and they were taken away. The authorities tried to rehome them. So we know that much, but they have still been on social media. They want to know the personal stories of these children and want to know further details about them.
Such a high-profile figure. I imagine it's caused a lot of emotional reaction among people in China.
Absolutely, yes. This was a huge story. I mean, because state media completely controls anything, it was absolutely everywhere. People saw it on TV, they heard about it in newspapers. So her fall from grace last year, similarly, there was so much publicity about this. People were horrified. And today, there's thousands of people on social media saying that they don't think 20 years is enough. They think she should get the death sentence, and saying that you can't manipulate children, you can't use them for your own personal gain.
Kerry Allen. Still to come on this Global News podcast, re-examining the Virgin Mary, but not everyone's convinced.
Would you say that she's representing church authority in the form of a bishop here?
No.
And why would not?
Because there's no such thing as a woman bishop, and there never has been.
Meet the woman trying to convince the Catholic Church to accept women bishops. Across much of Western Europe in the past 48 hours, it's been a case of soaring temperatures, tumbling records. Residents and visitors have sweltered in some of the hottest temperatures ever recorded. Here in the UK, we didn't quite get the hottest ever day, but Paris hit its all-time record, as did Germany, Belgium and the Netherlands for the second day running. Is it possible to enjoy it? Well, it is if you're confined to a comfortable air-conditioned radio studio. As far as the outside world is concerned, here's 60 seconds of sounds from the English seaside resort of Brighton, Paris's artificial beaches and the Belgian city of Liège, where an ambulance can be heard taking away someone who had fainted from heat exhaustion. So as the sun beats down, is there anything we can do in the short term to cope with these record-breaking temperatures without further worsening climate change? Dr. James Dyke is an environmental scientist at Exeter University.
There are many ways in which we can make immediate changes to the way that we live, which means that we will reduce the impacts of these extreme weather events at the same time as not actually making the situation worse. So I think one way to look at this is that livable cities are cooler cities. If we can imagine future cities which have significant shift from car congested roads, which can produce tremendously high local temperatures, and shift people into either walking or cycling down tree lined paths, we can see an implementation of massive tree planting and rewilding, not just in rural areas, but also in urban spaces, because trees and green areas can also significantly reduce temperatures. We also need to see a huge investment in insulating homes. Cooler homes in summer mean actually warmer homes in winter. So that means lower energy bills and carbon emissions, and also fewer cold related fatalities. And a well insulated home is going to be much cooler in this kind of oppressive heat that we've been witnessing over the past few days. And what really stresses people in terms of heat stress is not just the maximum temperatures during the day, but when those temperatures are maintained overnight and their body can't cool, when they don't have access to a cool space.
And I suppose people will also be saying what you're talking about, which is about how to combat the immediate effects, only underscores the need to try and combat climate change in the longer term.
We certainly can't outrun the impacts of climate change. We can do everything, and we should be doing everything right now, to both mitigate, to decarbonize the economy, and also to adapt as quickly as we can. And there are so many examples. There's so much low-hanging fruit that we can do right now in terms of insulation, in terms of livable cities, in terms of transport. that it's an outrage, really. It's shocking that some people are not just going to be inconvenienced by this recent weather, but they are going to lose their lives because we failed to adapt to the climate change we've already locked in. And when we look down the road towards the middle and the end of this century, when we could be seeing heat waves like this become the new normal, we have to do two things. We have to both mitigate and we have to adapt, and we have to do them both very urgently.
Dr. James Dyke of Exeter University talking to Tim Franks. Opposition parties and rebel groups in Sudan have agreed to resolve their differences and work together to conclude a transition deal with the ruling military regime. Some groups had denounced last week's power-sharing agreement between the opposition and the military, saying it did not represent their wishes. Our Africa security correspondent Tommy Oladipo sent this report.
Sudan's opposition groups have looked fragmented recently. This was most evident last week after the main alliance signed a power-sharing deal with the military. A coalition of rebel movements known as the Sudanese Revolutionary Front immediately rejected the pact, saying the concerns of Sudan's war-hit areas had been ignored. The opposition groups have been meeting in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, and have now agreed to include more of the armed movements in the transitional power-sharing government. They will return to Sudan to resume talks with the military with the hope of signing a detailed constitutional agreement. Meanwhile, the military says it has foiled an attempted coup and as a result arrested the military Joint Chief of Staff and several other senior security and political officials.
Tommy Oladipo. Brazil has banned them, so have Niger, Burkina Faso and Botswana and more than a dozen other countries. We're talking about donkey exports and how China's insatiable demand for the gelatin produced from boiling their skins for use in traditional medicines is threatening donkey populations around the world. Donkeys are still a crucial part of life for transport and farming, particularly in poorer communities. In Kenya, a report suggests donkeys could be wiped out if nothing is done to cut the slaughter rate. Tamazin Ford asked our correspondent in Nairobi, Ferdinand Amondi, how big the donkey trade in Kenya was.
It's very big. Ever since the government legalized the slaughter of donkeys in Kenya back in 2017, there's been a huge rise in donkey abattoirs. And right now, Brook East Africa, which is an action group working for horses and donkeys, estimates that there's the slaughter of at least 1,000 donkeys a day, which appears unsustainable.
1,000 donkeys a day. So then why doesn't Kenya follow suit and ban the trade like many other countries around the world?
I think the problem here is that it is only, it's only 3 years in, or just barely 2 years in since it was legalized. And there doesn't seem to be enough activism to try to engage the government. Brook East Africa said they've been trying to engage the government to give them the warnings because their last estimated donkey population in Kenya in 2009 was at about 1.8 million. And with this rate of slaughter, basically saying that Kenya could run out of donkeys in 10 years. But the fact that the slaughter is not really that much regulated, it is very difficult to access the abattoirs, and information on it also from government systems is non-existent. I think that is why it hasn't become much of a trouble, but there's a lot of activism now going on, and hopefully maybe at some point the government will see the sense in it.
So what would it mean for the country economically if the donkey population was wiped out?
It would mostly affect rural women in Kenya who are mostly concerned about the country's dwindling population. I mean, donkeys are very useful in helping women move heavy loads like water, building materials and firewood, especially in those areas. They're also the beasts of burden. And there's been a constant effort to try and make sure that for them this doesn't go away, because it means that they will go back to carrying heavy loads, they will go back, especially in the areas where they do majority of the work, especially in the semi-arid areas. And economically, this would simply reduce their work. I did the story a few months ago, and I saw how a woman was moving heavy building materials from the river to the construction areas. And without donkeys, this is something that they cannot be able to do. So it's a huge threat to the small economies, especially for rural women in rural Kenya.
Ferdinand Omondi in Nairobi. The Virgin Mary is revered in the Christian church as the mother of Jesus. But what if she was also once seen as a Catholic bishop capable of doing the work of a male priest? Would this mean that women should be accepted as Catholic priests today? That's the claim being made by an American historian, Ali Katus. She's the author of a book called Mary and Early Christian Women, Hidden Leadership. She took a correspondent, James Reynolds, to one of the pieces of evidence she's found behind the altar of a baptistery in Rome.
There she is. Ah. So the altar would have been here. Right.
Okay. So the figure... So on the ceiling behind the altar, there is a figure in blue in the centre with arms raised and a halo. Who is that?
Art historians agree that is Mary.
And what is your contention? What is she doing?
Well, the altar would have been right below. And originally, can you see that little bit of few red tesserae right in the middle of that long white strip? That's a pallium, an episcopal pallium with a red cross.
Pallium. Who wears red crosses? Only?
Bishops.
Bishops?
Yes.
You're saying Mary was a bishop?
I'm saying that Mary was seen as a bishop. The image of Mary in the early Christian era is very different than the image we see today.
Is one mosaic of Mary raising her hands enough to change the entire view of women's role in the church? That's an awful lot to base changing the view of the church on what we're looking at here.
Well, it's one of 60 images in my book.
Obviously, your contention is that Mary was depicted as a bishop. But in practical terms, did women ever serve as priests or bishops in the history of the Catholic Church?
I believe that from the very earliest Christian era, the data is clear that women did, and that they served in parallel with men at the altar, and also sometimes women alone were at the altar.
Tutti pensavano diverso, ma hanno lavorato insieme.
Pope Francis hasn't addressed the Mary as bishop claim. He has told reporters that he wants to learn more about how women may have helped the church in minor clerical roles in the past, but he doesn't go any further than that. The journalist Ines San Martin from the Crux website regularly travels on papal flights.
Pope Francis has been very clear when it comes to the ordination of women. That's a no-go.
Completely.
Ordination of women to the priesthood, women saying Mass, women hearing confession. He has told us on the plane several times that the door to that is closed. I know there are researchers out there who are probably convinced that Mary was, in fact, a bishop. Right now, what I can tell you as a journalist is that there is no evidence that backs it.
What happens if the evidence proved it?
Then we're going to have to review the past 2,000 years of history of the Catholic Church. You need a lot more than just a few mosaics.
Count that as one in the open to discussion column. So what about everyone else? Back at the church, I spot a perfect test case. On the other side of the altar, there is a very serious-looking tour guide.
My name is Gregory DePippo. I work as a guide, but I am also the editor of a website called the New Liturgical Movement.
I ask Ali Katous to try to persuade him of her claim that the mosaic above us depicts Mary as a bishop.
Arms raised, the altar directly below. Would you say that she's representing church authority in the form of a bishop here?
No.
And why would not?
Because there's no such thing as a woman bishop, and there never has been.
Okay.
Because, for example, this gesture appears that all over the place. It's a gesture of supplication. It has nothing
anyone do it?
That anyone can do. That
over
anyone
the altar.
Can do. It doesn't matter if it's over the altar. And so it appears all over the place. So, I'm sorry, but that's...
No luck, then. There may be those open to discussion about historical depictions of Mary as a cleric, but the convert counts during our short excursion remains at zero.
Our man in Rome, James Reynolds, reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.